Revolutions Per Minute is a weekly radio show from the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America. Recorded live at WBAI 99.5 in Brooklyn every Wednesday at 9 p.m. RPM's about doing the work to build a democratic socialist future. Each week, hear the latest news, analysis, and organizing experience from the minds and hearts of activists fighting every day in New York City. Join the movement at socialists.nyc.
Hey everybody, thank you so much for sitting through that. We were having some technical difficulties because it is very difficult to do all this remotely, and we're so grateful to WBI and Catherine in the studio, but we are here. This is Revolutions Per Minute. We are New York City's radio show. And today we are going to be talking about organizing in restaurants. On Monday, New York City shut down indoor dining at restaurants and bars as COVID cases continue to rise in the city and across the country. Many restaurants were barely surviving before New York City became the epicenter of the coronavirus pandemic earlier this year. And with little to no government support to make up for the loss of business needed to maintain necessary restrictions to stop the spread of COVID-19, restaurants and bars across the city are shutting their doors for good. And of course, the people most impacted in all of this are restaurant workers. Today, we'll be talking with Natalia, Paul, and Crystal, comrades from here in New York City and across the country in Minneapolis and Austin, who are organizing with the Restaurant Organizing Project, an effort to organize restaurant workers for relief and power on the job during COVID-19 and beyond. We'll talk about the many labor issues that existed for restaurant workers before COVID, how the pandemic has exacerbated those struggles while creating new ones, and how workers are fighting back. But first, the headlines with Simone Norman.
Governor Cuomo expressed interest in taxing the rich to close the state's multi-billion-dollar deficit, but he did not provide details and suggested it would be associated with cuts and borrowing. The New York Post covered NYC DSA's massive phone banking operation last week in support of the growing push to tax New York's rich. New York State Comptroller Thomas DiNapoli has agreed to divest the state's pension fund from most of its fossil fuel investments over the next 5 years. Assemblymember Robert Carroll of District 44 in Park Slope and Windsor Terrace has proposed a bill that would impose a $3 tax on all packages delivered in New York City, excluding food and medical supplies. The revenue would be directed towards the MTA. Despite significant activist opposition, the City Council Committee on Land Use approved the Flushing redevelopment after developers, elected officials, and labor unions came to an agreement on adding hundreds of jobs and more affordable housing. The vote passed 14-1, with only Councilmember Inez Barron of East New York voting no. Lindsay Boylan, who is running for Manhattan Borough President next year, accused Governor Cuomo of sexual harassment while she worked as an aide in his office and for having created a toxic team environment. A worker-owned ride-sharing app intended to compete directly with Uber and Lyft will launch in 2021. State Senator Brad Hoylman of District 27 in Midtown Manhattan is proposing legislation that would grant New York City the ability to lower its speed limit to 20 miles per hour from 25. The Brooklyn Democratic Party sued the state as part of a broader attempt to push insurgent and progressive factions out of the county's party's internal decision-making. In election news, at least four major candidates took significant steps towards running for mayor next year. Sean Donovan, a top housing official in the Bloomberg and Obama administrations, announced his bid for mayor. Former Sanitation Commissioner Catherine Garcia has formally entered the race. Former presidential candidate Andrew Yang has hired Mayor Bloomberg's former consultant to gauge his viability in the 2021 mayoral campaign. A poll recently showed Yang leading in a wide open field of candidates. And Representative Max Rose of New York 11, Staten Island and Bay Ridge, who lost his seat to Nicole Malliotakis in November, appears to be running for mayor as well. Some members of the City Council's Black, Latino, and Asian caucus are attempting to stop the rollout of ranked choice voting in 2021, claiming it would disenfranchise communities of color. DSA endorsee Brandon West of Council District 39 in Carroll Gardens has an op-ed in Gotham Gazette in support of rolling out ranked choice voting as planned. Whitney Hu has suspended her campaign for City Council District 38 in Sunset Park to focus on mutual aid. Three candidates are still running for the Bronx City Council seat vacated by Andy King in District 12, who was expelled for ethics violations in October. The special election will be held December 22nd. And finally, New York Focus reviewed the political donations of the New York Supreme Court candidates, finding that nearly all of them gave significant amounts of money to the Democratic Party leaders who nominate them.
An incredible weekly newsletter by New York City DSA, Electoral Working Group, covering local politics and radical activism. You can subscribe at thethorn.nyc. I'm Lisa Shi. I use she, her pronouns. And today we're talking with comrades from the Restaurant Organizing Project. So welcome all of you for being here. I'd like to first get our audience to get to know you a little bit. So I was wondering if you could introduce yourselves. I know some of you are joining us from different parts of the country. Talk a little bit about what your job is within the restaurant industry and how you got involved in DSA. And let's start with you, Natalia. Let's start with New York City first.
Yeah, always. Hey, I'm Natalia. I'm in New York City DSA. Thanks so much to Revolutions Per Minute. The radio show is just awesome. Such a great resource. I've been a restaurant worker for 15 years. I've been a socialist for about 12. And until recently, most of my activism was not centered on organizing inside restaurants, but that was all kind of flipped on its head because of the COVID crisis. And I've met so many amazing comrades across the country in this incredibly horrible, terrible.
Crystal, how about you?
Hi, I'm Crystal. She, her pronouns. I'm in Austin, Texas. So I've been in the service industry for over a decade. I'm originally from Australia, so it's pretty much the only industry I've worked in America. I had a little brief stint out, but I'm back now. Mainly a bartender. And as far as organizing, I actually didn't organize a whole lot until the pandemic, until I joined ROP. So, and then I had a lot of time on my hands. So now I'm here. So thank you for having us.
Yeah. And how about you, Paul?
Hey, I'm Paul. I use him pronouns. I live in Minneapolis right now, and I'm in DSA in the Twin Cities, as well as Restaurant Organizing Project. I've been in the industry for a while now, and I've done kind of all sorts of front of house jobs. Right now, I'm out of the industry working at a grocery store with a union right now for my first union, USCW. I've been a member of DSA since 2017, and I've been organizing with ROP since around April.
Cool. Well, thank you all so much for being here. And just for, you know, our listening audience, you know, my cred in all this is I'm an organizer. I do pipeline stuff, but that was only part-time for a lot. So I've worked a lot in the restaurant industries here in New York City over the years. So, you know, it's always been more of a side hustle for me, but I do have a little bit of restaurant cred. So we're definitely going to go into how COVID has impacted this industry. But first, I kind of want to set the scene a little bit. And there was lots of problems that existed in the restaurant industry, labor issues before COVID hit. Crystal, could you start us off and talk about what were some of the issues that existed before the pandemic?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, in the Austin industry, just even in January, we were hearing a lot about a big restaurant group that wasn't paying their employees, you know, wage theft, sexual harassment. We're an at-will state, so you can basically get fired from your job just on a personality conflict. You know, it was really bad here in Austin. We had a big incident with a couple of kind of bars and racism over the last few years. And I myself am like a very typical restaurant employee. I was right before the pandemic hit, kind of going through receiving DWIs through, you know, the funniness of the industry. I was drinking too much because I was opening restaurants, and as a bartender, I had to test all the drinks, and then you have to socialize, because if you're not in the clique when the restaurant opens, it can actually impact your like income, which is crazy. It's like high school. And I mean, I'm in my mid 30s now. So it's like a game that is really tiring to play, but you have to play this game. And, you know, in Texas, we're getting paid $2.13 an hour. So if no one comes into your shift, you just don't make money. And if, well, as long as you average $7.25 over the pay period, they don't have to do anything for you. And that's crazy. While I was dealing with my DWI, I also got this job because they promised they would give me health insurance, and I have bipolar disorder. So I need consistent treatment. Like, it's just non-negotiable. After 6 months of being there, they informed me that they had made sure my hours were low enough where I was not entitled to health coverage. And they were telling me this right as I was turning into jail for my DWI. When I returned from my jail sentence, they fired me for no reason because they just felt I was no fit. And they told me they would let me get unemployment. They just didn't want me there anymore. And like, that is such a typical story. So when we hit pandemic, it was like we were already at the breaking point. And now we've seen like the true colors of people that have told us we're this family for so many years. And now we're really seeing how the family treats you.
Yeah, no, I've had that shift where they're like, oh, well, we'll give you some extra food, because like nobody came in for that whole shift. It is a struggle. And, you know, we don't see as many unions in restaurants and stuff. Paul, maybe can you talk a little bit about some of the, you know, dynamics that exist that have made it very hard to organize within restaurants?
For sure. You know, first of all, like, this is typical of like every single industry in the U.S. The biggest hurdle is going to be at-will employment compared to a lot of other countries. You can get fired for literally any reason in the U.S. Besides that, another thing that's kind of similar with a lot of other industries, we have super high turnover. It's a really transient industry. So restaurants are opening and closing all the time. People are switching jobs a lot of the time. There's also a lot of divisions between back of house, front of house, dishwashers and cooks. Also with like a lot of language differences, you know, I've worked at places where like, we're like, it's really segregated, where back of house is, I worked at a place where back of house was mostly Vietnamese, front of house was mostly white, and dishwashing was mostly Latino. And that's like very, very typical. Kind of also some kind of unique issues with restaurants. They're very, very small, dispersed shops, usually low profit margins. So, and there's also not a lot of production. So there's not a lot of capital invested by the owners, which makes it really, really easy for the owners to just leave, shut down, do anything they can to stop a union, because they don't have a lot invested a lot of the time. I do want to say, like, we see lots of activism in the restaurant industry, but it's the kind of, and a lot of worker organizing, but it's not like the traditional union organizing we see a lot of time. It's the kind of Johnny Paycheck, like, take this job and shove it, I'm not working here anymore kind of attitudes. Like, a lot of, you know, you'll see a lot of times people just like quitting because they're tired of working, and you can get another job in the industry really easily a lot of the time. So a lot of that, a lot of kind of Instagram call outs, mass firings. So we see workers active and organized and organizing themselves a lot. It's just not usually the typical kind of unionization strategy.
Yeah. And so, you know, we are the Democratic Socialist Show. Natalia, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, as we're doing all this work towards socialism, like, how do you envision that, you know, restaurants could look different, this industry? Like, how would the industry be better for workers and for customers under socialism?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things is that I don't think restaurants as we know them would exist under socialism. Like, I think that eating and sharing food is a universal thing that everybody needs and desires, and it's like one of the best things in life. And it's kind of this tragedy that under capitalism, everything, even if it has a need value, even if it's something that you need to survive and to sustain your soul, you know, human interactions and food, it becomes something that's given kind of an exchange value, a monetary value. And restaurants in particular, like, it's the commodification of human interactions. It's like the commodification of food that has to be bought and that you don't have access to if you don't actually have the money to buy it. but it's also the commodification of the idea that you pay somebody to be nice to you and serve you and attend to you. And I think, you know, it kind of takes some of the nicest things in life and makes them kind of strange, bizarre, gross interactions. And ideally, like in a society where people had their needs met, we would have, you know, communal fooderies that everybody could access, but that wouldn't be, it wouldn't be something that was kind of bought and sold on a market. It would be something that would be for the fulfillment of human interactions and human growth. So that's the goal.
You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 and streaming on your favorite podcast app. To connect with us after the show, you can email us at revolutionsnyc@gmail.com. And you can find all of our past episodes on revolutionsperminute.simplecast.com. And as always, you can find us on Twitter at NYCRPM. Today, we are joined by comrades of the Restaurant Organizing Project. We just went through some of the issues that existed within the restaurant industry before the pandemic hit. Obviously, here in New York City, where restaurants are such a huge part of the culture, and we were the epicenter of the pandemic, there's been a lot of struggle, a lot of controversy over whether people are being kept safe. I'm wondering, Paul, if you can kind of talk about how some of the challenges that existed already before the pandemic have gotten worse. And do you think, and maybe you can first talk about where you are and then other people can chime in, but, you know, do you think people are being kept safe right now with the restrictions that are in place for COVID?
In restaurants, you know, COVID is an airborne disease. And so any indoor area is going to spread COVID. And restaurants, you know, you're not wearing a mask when you're eating or drinking. You can't. So no matter what, indoor restaurants are going to spread COVID. And beyond that, the restaurant industry has no history of taking safety precautions for anything. And so surprise, surprise, they're not doing a great job right now. Any industry worker, you can like look up their arms and they'll have scars from like, cooks will have tons of scars from like working burners, burns on their hands. Like, you know, an old cook because they don't have any feeling in their, any nerve feeling in their hands anymore. Right. Also, you know, accidents, like my first serving job I got, you know, I like had to go to PT because my shoulder was completely worn out after like a week of holding plates. And then there's a huge, huge, there's no sick leave. Like people come in at, when they're sick all the time, they're asked to, even if there's not, there's a culture that you just kind of like man up and do it. So we're seeing right now that a lot of the guidelines that restaurants have in place are mostly sanitary theater. Like they're going to, you know, do a really careful job of wiping the table after you leave. But at the end of the day, it's an indoor airborne, it's an indoor place without masks on in an airborne disease. You know, a worker that I talked to that had a story that really struck to me where the owner put on all the websites that they go above and beyond the CDC guidelines, which meant, you know, they wiped everything down extra hard. You know, the bathrooms were really clean, but at the same time, they're telling people someone came in with a positive test and the owner told this person to not tell anyone else that they got a positive test and then told everyone else to not get tests at all because they wanted to make sure they would still have enough staff to open up the next day. And that's really typical. It's very, very surface level stuff. But as anyone who's worked in a restaurant or anywhere in the service industry knows, a restaurant that looks kind of clean on the outside most of the time is not going to, a lot of the time, I should say, is going to have something bad on the inside.
Yeah, Natalia, is that what you've seen here in New York City as well as far as, you know, these COVID precautions? And then maybe also, could you talk a little bit too, you know, there's a lot of undocumented people in the restaurant industry, you know, especially here in New York City and in other places. Can you maybe also talk about a little bit too about how that's impacted these workers? Because, you know, like, you know, my boyfriend worked at a restaurant and he was, you know, they laid off everybody when they shut down, but, you know, he was able to get unemployment. Obviously, some of the people who were working in the restaurant might not have been able to get that as well, and how it's impacted those folks.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, what Paul described, it's just basically, it's this industry that's incredibly decentralized. There's really, even in the best of times, like, there's all these laws that exist, but when you go inside the workplace, we laugh about the laws because they don't exist inside the workplace. Like the idea of breaks, the idea of like any kind of protocol, there's really no oversight. And I'd say there's continuum, like different restaurants are doing different precautions, but I can say that most of the people I know in restaurants, there's no expectation that you're getting tested. There's no expectation that like there's actually screening or that you could actually call in sick. Or if you do call in sick, you're worried you're going to lose your job. It's really like this industry in particular is incredibly difficult when it comes to a health pandemic, because there's always going to be, unless there's a complete bailout of the entire industry, there's going to be this compulsion to keep things open, to be able to make money and stay afloat no matter what. And I feel like we've seen kind of health versus money pitted against each other over and over again since the pandemic started. And in New York, they've done a lot of things for business owners. Like they allow the outdoor dining, which is basically, you know, they've passed all this public property over to private businesses. To allow them to kind of stay afloat through the spring and the summer. And you know, there's just a lot of inconsistency in terms of the regulations, and they've been changing honestly, like week to week, the regulations from the city have been changing. And that also is an indication that there's really no thought being put into what would actually make a restaurant safe to eat at. And like Paul said, there's literally no way to eat at a restaurant safely. It's just not, like, it's an airborne disease. You have to take off your mask to eat. That's just the basic thing. There's no way to eat inside a restaurant safely, which means there's no way to work inside a restaurant safely. So obviously there's a lot more to say, but when it comes to, I think the thing that we've talked about a lot and we need to talk about more is like immigrant workers are the backbone of the restaurant industry, especially Latino workers, like period. In 2006, I don't know if folks remember, but there was a day without an immigrant in response to a federal anti-immigrant bill that shut down restaurants across the country. So like, to be honest, it's like immigrant workers are kind of the key to the self-activity of immigrant workers is the most important factor in whether we're going to be able to organize this industry. There's two things that exist side by side. One is kind of like the burden that's been put on essential workers, and two is the unemployment crisis. So essential workers, undocumented people are much more likely to be essential workers. And they've been working overtime and they've been doing all this work to make sure that people can stay home but still get goods. So it's like Amazon and Instacart and all these delivery services. And they've worked through the whole pandemic. There's in New York, like the communities that have the highest rates of COVID at the height of in the spring were the immigrant communities, because people were forced to work like double duty extra all the time. People could still get goods and still make it through and not have to go outside themselves. And there's been actually like a significant, one of the things that's significant is organizing amongst delivery workers. In New York, on December 6th, there was a rally of the deliveristas, they call themselves. They were organizing around hours and abuse from the apps, which is basically like an Uber-like app, but for delivering delivering food from restaurants. Like they get very low pay, very small cut, and work incredible hours. And that's actually, it's an international phenomenon as well. Some of the delivery workers organizing themselves. There was a massive one-day strike in Sao Paulo in July. And I think it's one of the things that like this particular side of the industry has grown a lot during COVID. So there's people who are completely overworked, completely being put under enormous strain and risking their lives. And also because of that, I think starting to organize. But then it's not, immigrants are, undocumented workers are more likely to be essential, but they're also more likely to be unemployed since COVID. And the unemployment crisis affects the immigrant, you mentioned this, Lee, but like it affects the immigrant community in much, much different ways than it affects citizens. You have zero access to federal relief, zero access to food stamps, zero access to unemployment insurance, zero access to rent relief. And that also impacts the reality of all kinds of things in terms of accessing healthcare, but also you're more likely to be in a unstable living situation where you could be evicted for literally no reason because you don't have a lease. So it's just like you think like it compound, all these issues compound each other. And I think, you know, there's been some really good articles kind of highlighting some of these, the realities for immigrant workers. But I do think like in restaurants in particular, like immigrant workers in restaurants have always organized and are organizing. And like I said, it's like if we're going to have a successful restaurant organizing project, it's going to be those people at the center of it. So I definitely think COVID has, COVID has put new pressures and new like terrible a new terrible situation for undocumented workers that everybody should be in solidarity with those people, kind of doing that work and standing up against what's going on.
Yeah, and there was a really one of those articles on immigrant delivery drivers recently came out in the city, and you know mentioned that a lot of these workers from Guatemala and different you know countries, you know their indigenous cultures have you know really rich histories of resistance to capitalism and colonialism. So I thought that was a really interesting. And also, you know, if there's anybody that is ordering delivery tonight or tomorrow, like, tip the crap out of your workers. These people are working so hard. So just, you know, always, always tip your delivery drivers. And I mean, we could probably have a whole episode on just like what a disaster it is between like restaurants and apps and how like so much food gets wasted and like is cold and it's really nobody's fault except like algorithms. So no matter what, tip your delivery drivers. You know, and you did mention that there's been, you know, very little support from the government, you know, regulations are, you know, constantly changing. I saw this one report that, you know, up to 50% of restaurants may close because of this. Crystal, you know, what do you think is going to happen? And, you know, are governments reaching out to restaurants and restaurant workers at all to get their input? I mean, it really does not seem like anybody who's managed a restaurant or worked at a restaurant is making any of these decisions.
Yeah, that's what's so wild about it is like, there's this narrative out there right now that's actually currently getting pushed by the Independent Restaurant Coalition, which is Tom Colicchio's business. And it's about save restaurants and how we need to save restaurants, but they're not talking about restaurants. Oh, they're talking about restaurants. They're not talking about restaurant workers. And that's like what keeps getting skipped. Like I was on town halls with Senator Cornyn, like his office, 2 weeks in a row in the summer talking about unemployed workers. And I had his office staff just telling us all the performative nonsense that they were, you know, told they had to say to us. They had restaurant workers crying on the phone, like begging for help. And we're getting told by these office aides that, well, the senator, you know, his heart is with us and he's doing everything he can to fight for us. And he's trying to support, you know, the Save Our Stages Act and all that. And like, then the next day he's coming out and trying to push for a Supreme Court nominee and still not speaking to why there is no relief package hitting the Senate floor right now. And this guy got reelected. That's what really is disheartening to the service industry is, we hear constantly in every movement that ever hits, this is not unique to COVID. You know, like right now it's just constant. We're hearing these constant band-aid solutions to what we really know the answer is, which is close every restaurant and pay every worker to stay home, freeze the rent and keep the business. Like the business owners should not be pressuring us to save their businesses. You pay me $2.13 an hour. You know, I don't owe you anything. Actually, you owe me now, and you're leaving me in the cold. And you're telling me right now that I'm eligible for $70 a week in unemployment benefits that will be cut off on December 26th. And I'm getting told that I still need to wait my turn and save a business owner first. The same business owner that wouldn't give me health care last year when they promised they would. The same business owner that told me that my harassment complaints about his sous chef were invalid and that I was being dramatic. Like the same business owners that stole money from me the year before, forget that. I'm over that. It's your turn. If we are family, then where the hell are you? Because I have not seen any business owner go protest, save my employees. I've seen the Save Our Bars protest. I couldn't care less if your brick and mortar crumbles because the workers that make your brick and mortar special are the people you're leaving out in the cold. We also have business owners using this opportunity to union bust, which is disgusting. And like they're getting away with it because our customers still believe that people like Tom Colicchio, when he's out there saying save restaurants means us, but it does not mean us. And so that's like our biggest challenge is that as every city, as every mayor puts out whatever new, like, oh, we're going to do have a new to-go restriction that actually has no teeth. Because if you go and make a complaint, you'll get fired or no one will do anything or whatever. Like, see, why are people still having liquor licenses if they're violating these COVID restrictions? Why have our OSHA laws not evolved in this pandemic yet? Like, why are we still making these stupid restrictions on 50% indoor dining when we know for a fact science says that does not work? And countries like Australia, where I'm from, and New Zealand are embarrassing us on the world stage. Like, when I moved here, I was sold this type of dreams of, like, greatest country in the world. We're, like, this, that, and the other. And then I got here and realized you're all gaslit under this abusive relationship, and it's crazy to me. So it's like every movement's missed us. Me Too movement never hit the service industry. We're not like letting this COVID pandemic skip us this time. If all these good bosses are out there and they feel that like the Save Our Restaurant thing is for us, then they need to also be demanding that it gets rewritten to include the unemployed restaurant workers that don't have a job to go back to. Our business is gone already. Like, what about the people that, you know, just can't find work? I can't find work. And I'm also getting retaliated against because I am very vocal about these worker rights in my town. And it's a small town. And my name is Mud because of it. But I don't care because I don't want to work for those people. But unfortunately, they're the people that are going to get these relief packages, still going to treat their workers like garbage. So where is the language getting written that says, if we find out you take these loans and then union bust, you repay the money to us? Or we find out that your chef has been harassing staff for years and verbally abusing them and you're promoting these people. Why are you getting money again? Like, that is the conversation we need to start having. And on top of that, we also need to be talking more about, like, if someone says to you, well, I really want to support a restaurant, so I'm going to go and dine in there because I want to make sure that restaurant worker is taken care of. Actually, the best thing you can do is make sure that everyone understands the best thing for that worker is the business to close its doors and for the government to pay them to do that. And that's like the only answer. Any other thing you are doing is pushing the narrative that these Band-Aid solutions are okay, and then you're allowing us to get forgotten again. Because once the vaccines come and everyone gets them, conversation's over. We will be forgotten again. And that's like what I think we're really trying to hard to fight and make sure it doesn't happen anymore too.
Thank you so much for you know, speaking up, even though, you know, it does make you a target. And amen to saving restaurant workers and not restaurants. And so I definitely want to dig into how you all are doing that through the Restaurant Organizing Project. But just want to let our listeners know we will be opening up the phone lines very soon. So that number is 212-209-2877. Again, that number is 212-209-2877. But before we hear from some of our callers, Natalia, can you talk a little bit about what is the Restaurant Organizing Project and what will you guys be focusing on in 2021?
Yeah, so the Restaurant Organizing Project is one of many new restaurant worker organizations, and we are open to any restaurant worker who wants to organize to make the industry better. We are organized around, we do national calls that bring people like Paul and Crystal and I, but like times 100 onto different calls to have some of these discussions. Because like Paul was saying before, it's like, we know what's wrong with the industry, but we haven't quite as an industry figured out the key to being able to shift it and make things change and make things actually organized for the workers in the industry for a whole number of different historical reasons. And we want the restaurant industry to be part of the labor movement. It's been isolated and sidelined from the demands of the labor movement for a long time. And we want to bring it more into the center of the bigger discussions that are happening about what needs to change for working people. Our main campaign right now is around helping people who want to do workplace organizing. So we have materials, we do trainings, we do follow-up with people who are trying to figure out what their next step is. And it's all kind of based on this idea that in restaurants, there's no equation that's going to allow you to do A plus B equals I'm an organized restaurant, that actually we need restaurant workers who have, you know, put some time and energy and thought into how we're going to get around some of the pitfalls of just kind of being pushed out of a workplace or just a workplace going under. And there's a lot of obviously discussions that need to happen around that. We organize chapters. So in different cities, we have networks of restaurant workers who are having those discussions and organizing together. And one important aspect of what we do is emergency solidarity efforts. So in different cities, in Colorado Springs, in Austin, in Boise, Idaho, there's all kinds of workplace struggles that happen that require emergency response so that the workers aren't retaliated against and just kind of crushed. And we've found that the places where there's able to be a relationship between the people who are organizing inside the workplace and the people who are out and people outside the workplace drawing attention to it is where some of the most successful union drives and workplace actions have taken place. And we also, you know, I do think like what Crystal was saying, it's like at a certain point, there's going to be a vaccine and restaurants are going to reopen. And we want to use this time to prepare ourselves to be like, at some point, like things are going to go back inside those restaurants. And what are restaurant workers inside those places going to be thinking when this pandemic is over? And how are we going to use this moment to get ourselves more organized so that when we hit the ground, you know, back full fledged restaurants, we could still be picking up these threads about what is it going to take to actually upend some of the incredibly terrible practices in restaurants that make our lives so precarious and make it so only 14% of restaurant workers have access to health insurance through their jobs. And, you know, the minimum wage for tipped workers is still $2.13 an hour, whatever. There's a long list of things, racism, immigrant rights, a whole list of things that are part of the same discussion. And you can find, we have a whole number of upcoming events and things. You can find all of our stuff on Twitter at Restaurant Proj, Restaurant P-R-O-J, or on Facebook, facebook.com/DSA Restaurant. And you can also reach out to us, dsa.restaurantproj@gmail.com with anything to plug in. We're open to any restaurant worker who wants to make things better.
Yeah. So if you're a restaurant worker listening to us now, or you have thoughts about whether restaurants should be open or not, you know, give us a call. The number is 212-209-2877. Again, that number is 212-209-2877. So I was actually listening into one of the restaurant organizing project calls a couple weeks ago, and there was all these cool stories of different organizing popping off all across the country. Paul, could you maybe talk about some of that, like how different people are responding to this moment?
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, again, first of all, the first thing we're seeing a lot of workers doing spontaneous organizing. It's taking the place mostly of, you know, walkouts, Instagram callouts, protests, swearing at your boss. You know, it's the workers are leading it. And so a lot of the stuff we're doing is, like Natalia said, emergency response, Boise, Colorado Springs, other places. When workers are going out, making sure we have their back, sending them solidarity, and then helping along the path of forming unions, doing picket lines, strategic research on their boss, et cetera, et cetera. Besides that, we've also seen a lot of chapters organized around relief for restaurant workers. New Orleans did a big push in coalition. The New Orleans DSA chapter did a big push in coalition with a lot of other local groups for an emergency relief fund for restaurant workers earlier. We've seen people in Denver, in Chicago, and all around Texas, like Crystal, organize actions around unemployment relief, trying to get people back on unemployment, raising awareness of the issue. And then we've also seen in cities like Los Angeles and Ann Arbor, restaurant workers do a lot of mutual aid work. We've also seen a lot of unionization campaigns and workers really starting to take power in their own hands and form unions. Out here in the Twin Cities, there is a big push, a big kind of mini wave starting in June with, I want to give a shout out to Tattersall Distillery, Fair State Brewery, Lalo Stillhart Distillery, the workers at Surly Brewing and Spy House Coffee, who have all either successfully formed unions or fell victim, a couple of them fell victim to union busting campaigns. San Francisco, starting with the Anchor Union last year, has really led the way on this, and they've been doing a lot of work. I want to give a shout out to them. And then nationally, through a group kind of started through Denver DSA with partnership with Unite Here, the Restaurant Workers United has done a lot of work helping out workers trying to unionize all over the place. Hopefully we'll see some of that pop off next year. You know, it, with unionization, it's all going to be under wraps until the last minute, but that's the way we do it, so the bosses won't find out. So it's been a lot of different little things, and the thing is, you know, it's been a crazy year. No one predicted anything that was going to happen in 2020. But if there's one thing restaurant workers know to do, it's roll with the punches. One of my friends, my friend Bennett from Tattersall, said it best. He said, unionization campaign is just like a Thursday night shift. It gets tricky, but you just stick with it, you know? So that's what restaurant workers do.
Yeah, and solidarity to everybody building power in all those ways. We do have one caller on the line. Caller, you are now live on WBAI. What is your name and comment or question?
Hi, how are you? Antonio in the Bronx. I became a chef a while ago, and leading up to it, I saw things in the industry that I never signed on for. And I appreciate sharing your personal experience about how it is about the owners and the pay and all of that. I totally have seen that and more. You know, I always said, I came to the conclusion that if an establishment's business model exists or is supported by you paying me $9 an hour, you shouldn't be in business. So the COVID thing seems to be, at least for now, push those people to the side, put them out of business. And again, that was the tipping point. They shouldn't be in business. But they were mistreating people, so they got a dose of their own medicine. Just today, the mayor announced you got to close your outdoor cafe. As a matter of fact, he says, you don't have to, but we're encouraging you to take the outside cafe down. So they're really sending these restaurant people through the ringer. And then the sexual harassment, the Mary Batali thing, what a mess. So I encourage you guys organizing. I worked in Yankee Stadium in 2009. Just a mess that the union, Local 100 is, that's there. They promised me a cook's job. And then after 6 weeks of tagging everybody along, I was a prep. And then I tried to get the position, and I had to go to EEOC and NLRB, and nothing worked. Nothing helped. You got to, keep the union people accountable, them too. But they're very crafty, trying to, you know, pick off who the troublemakers are to them, and so on and so on. It's you got to be united and steadfast, and everybody should be making more than $15 an hour. Things need to straighten up. Like people in the kitchen who are working the hardest, and why do people come for the food? You can have a waiter or a sommelier or a manager in the front making more, or somebody in the office for that matter, than the person in the kitchen. I didn't sign on for that. And then they get you going because you've got all these people trying to become the chef. That's where you make the money, but there's only one or two positions for that. So, wonderful. I support you guys. I'm going to contact your organizations and see if I can get on board, lend some of my ideas to, and please repeat the contact numbers and emails again slowly. Thank you.
Yeah, Crystal, I don't know if you want to respond, and then maybe Natalia, you can give those numbers or that info one more time, or Crystal.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling in, because I think that your experience is really common, and it's what a lot of folks hear. My roommate is actually a kitchen manager, and so I definitely hear a lot of his back-of-house struggles and woes, and a lot of my friends, of course. I always make friends with my back-of-house homies, but that's sort of a tactic that these bosses use they've been using for years to keep us from organizing together, is that back of house, front of house divide. Like the back of house guys, why are they making such a significantly, so much less? And then even in the front of house, they'll do the same, where it's like your shift leaders, trainers are going to get the best shifts and the best this and the best that. Then everyone else is going to get the crumbs that you have to fight for. And you have to infight with each other because everyone's got to get on the side of the guy that's writing the schedule. And it's just like, who needs that stress if you're not even going to give me like health insurance so I can mentally deal with it? And like one of our, I run our Texas chapter's Instagram, and like one of our most popular posts was a repost from the Chad Project, which is in Chicago. And it was all about like breaking down trauma in the industry. And it was like beyond triggering for people. They were sliding into our DMs to talk about it. And it's really something I think that in the industry we already know, but like, our customers just don't know it's like this. And I'm glad that like so much has changed this year where we're really fed up, like even just having these conversations, it was never acceptable before, but now just having, you know, someone be able to call in and say, yeah, this is my experience too. That is a huge shift from this time, just last year even. And that's like really exciting as well.
Natalia, do you want to just give that info one more time real quick as we wrap up here? You're on mute.
Sorry, dsa.restaurantproj@gmail.com. If you email that, we check it every day. We will plug you right into some organizing. We will link you up with people in your city who are doing this work, and we will organize and win a better industry.
Thank you so much for listening to Revolutions Per Minute. We will catch you next week on RPM, same time, 9 p.m. Thanks so much for being on.